position number 22333, wheel 15.
This is the eighth reel of a taped interview with Jim McKenzie in his home in Perth, Western Australia, on the 6th of the 9th, 2001, for the Imperial War Museum in London, and the interviewer is John Bannister. Jim, I wanted to talk about the process of you coming home, coming back to Australia. Could you tell us about that?
Yes, well, the war finished in Borneo. We heard about the cessation of hostilities and the final atom bomb just about my birthday, about the 13th of August. And from then on, it was just a case of mopping up Japanese in the way of saying mopping up, collecting them as prisoners, those who came and surrendered, and then looking after them now and again when we were detailed to look after them in their camps.
You'd spoken about making them parade in front of you and all of that sort of thing. I wanted to know, though, whether you at any point came close to any of them or at least spoke to them about their experiences.
No,
or your experience.
No, never. We hated the Japanese. There's no other word for it. We'd seen what they'd done to prisoners, and while we were there in Borneo at the end of the war, we saw a few of the Indians that they had, and so badly treated they were that we couldn't understand how anybody. We at that time we didn't know about our own POWs being badly treated. We'd never heard a word about them. But we saw these Indians, the way they had been treated, not so much the natives in the old Borneo. We didn't notice that they had been ill-treated, but we did notice the others. Anyhow, we stayed in Borneo for a while. We were camped on the seashore, had quite a good time. At that time, we were about 40 strong, because the 5.5-year-old, they are the men who had been with us in the, not the 5.5-year-old, they were with us, stayed behind. But the remaining battalion had joined the brigade and gone over to Macassar. And afterwards we found out what a wonderful job they'd done over there. Their discipline had been wonderful. They had had to cope with many thousand of Japanese surrendering. And in that way, their discipline and the way they'd behaved was exemplary. We heard all this afterwards. They'd had trouble with the Dutch, who wanted to take over, and they'd also had trouble with the communists among the native Macassians. They had caused trouble. But when our troops showed force, they'd soon backed down. They really had no guts, except to... looking after their politics without coming out to the fore in any way. But that is, I know nothing about that, I wasn't there. Anyhow, eventually we came home. We had been delayed over there. We thought we were going to come home by air, but we actually found out afterwards that any air from Moratai to Borneo was very scarce, and especially from Australia, from Moratai back to Australia, because the soldiers on Moratai, they were line troops, and they did not want to return to Australia till they'd had spent a certain time overseas in Moratai. Whereas we were dead keen to get back very quickly, they were dead keen to stay. And unfortunately, a few of our troops, about 20 of them, who had got special leave to go home to their families, were marooned on Moratai for that reason. They couldn't get passage back to Australia. We, after a while, got onto a boat. It was the first time we'd been on a boat where they had lights during the war. The boat was all lit up. It was a British boat, and they had been up to Singapore to pick up the hospital personnel from the who had cared for the POWs in Singapore when the war ceased. Tom. They had stayed behind, and there were no POWs with them, but they told us how they stayed behind for a while, or they stayed in Singapore for a while, and fattened them up so that when they came home, they would not shock their people so much with the way the conditions they were in. Because we were told by these personnel on the hospital ships how poorly they were treated and the terrible condition that they were in, starvation.
Well, if you'd known this while you were looking after Japanese, how do you think you would have treated the Japanese differently?
It would have made no difference at all. We had been at war for 5.5 years and we were disciplined. And we never expected the Japanese to take us prisoners, but we expected the Germans and the French to capture us and treat us properly. But we then, as I said, had no idea how the Japanese had treated their prisoners till we got onto the ship and heard from the hospital personnel how badly they had been treated. The hospital personnel, it was their first time out of Australia, and of course it was quite an experience for them. They had collected a lot of souvenirs, field glasses and things like that, that we had never had a chance to collect, and if we had had a chance, we couldn't have brought them home, because we just weren't allowed to come home without anything except our own personal belongings.
You mentioned earlier that you'd heard about the atomic bomb. What were your feelings on the use of the atomic bomb, particularly in relation to what you were hearing about the way the Japanese had treated your troops?
Well, when we first heard about the atomic bomb, we were so very, very glad, because we had understood that prior to that, we were going to be used, our division, was going to be used in an attack on Japan or islands very near to Japan. And we'd heard and we knew how fanatical the Japanese were, how they would resist it to every man. And we were scared, I suppose, in a way, that was going to happen to us. Now, I shouldn't have said scared, because I still think we're too well disciplined to let it worry us very much. But we knew, like we had known when we thought we were going to Burma, that we'd probably never see Australia again. That was our feelings. When we heard about the atomic bomb, we were so very, very glad. It was wonderful news to us to know that the war had ended like that, with such a waste of life that would have occurred if we would have had to attack Japan. That were our feelings. I remember them so well.
What were the feelings then on board ship in relation to the fact that you knew the war was over and you were coming home?
Well, there again, it was a wonderful feeling. We had contact, I suppose, you can say, with the nurses on board and the hospital troops who had been on this trip up to Singapore. But I'm afraid we looked rather down on them, because that was the first time they'd been out of Australia. And they told us all the souvenirs they'd got, watches, everything, whereas we hadn't got anything. And when they eventually put up one ribbon to show that they had been out of Australia, we then, or some of our officers, decided that we would show our ribbons. And it was rather startling, I think, to see these troops when some of our men put up MCs, DCMs, MMs, MIDs, and three ribbons that we had been given. And we'd had them in our kit bag, but we'd never shown them, of course. And I think it was rather a shock to these other troops, But it was rather wonderful. We had lights, we had good tucker, and we eventually found that we were coming home to our home state, Fremantle, and I'd been expecting to go to Sydney and meet my fiancée, who was in the nursing crowd. Instead of that, we arrived back in Fremantle. Now, do you want to hear that? When we arrived back in Fremantle, some of our people were on the wharf. They met us. My good army friend and I, we joined our fiancé, who'd managed to come, his wife, and in my case, my fiancé. We went up to my fiancé's home and met her parents again, and that was it. There was no passing out, no parade through the streets. We just came off the ship, dispersed, away to the country, as a lot of our chaps did. And there weren't many of us, mind you, there were only a few. I think it was about 44, 45 of us. That's all that were left. And we just dispersed. After a while, it must have been about a fortnight, I was speaking to my mate one day, and he said, "Jim, don't you think we'd better get out of the army?" So then we decided, yes, we'd go down to Karakata and see about getting out of the army. We went down to Karakata, found that we were the last ones to be to get out, and it was quite an experience. There we met an officer who had been no good in the Middle East. He's been sent back to Australia as not a fighting man. And there we found him sitting on the end of the desk, swinging his legs and wanting us to demobilise us. I immediately asked for a brigadier who I knew well. I knew him before the war. I went to school with him and I asked to see him. I went in and got the brigadier to demobilise me. And then that was the end of the show. That was the end of the army.
What was the feeling of sort of coming home and after all the things you'd experienced, just coming home and nothing really happening?
No, didn't worry us at all. Our main concern was getting petrol ration tickets and our butter and our meat and our sugar ration and the tea rations that we drew. And they were to last us for a month or several weeks anyhow. That was our main concern. But we were so very happy to be out and away from it all. I never saw a parade in the street, and I never saw any great excitement at all. Naturally, I met my friends, and I was greeted by them. And I also, unfortunately, met a lot of people who had lost their dear ones with us. And it was a very sad occasion. But otherwise, there was no jubilation at all. I eventually got married, went away on a honeymoon, and then went back to the farm and got stuck into the hard work. And that's the end of my life. My only other worry after the war was when my son became of age or old enough to go up to Vietnam, and I dead scared, very scared indeed, that he would have to go. At that time, the Australian politicians had decided that they would conscript so many men, so many boys, they were boys of a certain age, and send them over to Vietnam. And they had a draw for that. If you're unlucky enough to be drawn, the ticket would be drawn, your number would be drawn, you went. But luckily my son did not have to go. I don't know whether he would have been keen to go or not. He'd been in the cadets at school. He'd volunteered for those. But I certainly did not want him to go. I knew what war was. and I did not want him to go. As I said just now, he was lucky enough not to be to lose his, or not to lose, what I can't use the word, to go away.
I wanted to ask you how you sort of felt about the war on your return, your involvement in it, and what it had all meant. Did you have an opinion about that at all when you came back?
Yes, unfortunately, when we first went to war, when I say first went to war, when we went overseas and came back, and the first time into the islands, it was a different feeling. Because we had enlisted to fight, and when we got back to the island, Australia, and had to go to the islands, we knew we had to fight to the, what you might say, the death. Because we knew that the Japanese would, what they were like. We'd understood, we'd heard about them in China, and we'd heard about them in Singapore and the islands. But we had never fought them before, but we had heard about them. And even to this day, I would never invite a Japanese personnel of my age or younger, this is what I held right from the war on to the present day, that I'd never invite one of those into my home. Never. I would invite young children, young Japanese, but I would never invite anybody of my age into my home. I just could never stomach it. We actually hated them. It was more than hate. I don't know how to express it. We just would not count them. And my friends were the same. My army mates were the same. They just could not take any bar of them at all. And it hurt us a lot, especially me as a farmer, that I had to hear afterwards and had to more or less buy Japanese goods, vehicles and things like that. But I would never go to Japan and set foot in Japan as a tourist. And most of my army mates were the same. We just would not do it. But we had I don't know, the war itself, it was such a shambles at the end. It was a politician's war, we thought. We had politicians coming over, and they had no idea of it, what was going on. One of them came to New Guinea, in Moresby, and we actually saw him walking around in his bare feet. Now, that is something we would never have done, and we weren't never allowed to do, because you had got this disease, worms and things like that, in between your toes. And we never did it. But there we saw this politician come across there and do it. Another case, one of them visited our camp in Queensland, and I actually wasn't there at the time. I'd been away on exercise, but I came back, and I heard that he'd just played a brief visit to us, and then he'd gone to brigade, and he insisted on taking his son, who was a private in the militia, who had accompanied him, insisted taking him into the officer's mess. Well, that's something we couldn't understand, because it was never done. There was nothing that we do. All our troops didn't like it, but it was army etiquette. You just did not do those sort of things. You were like going across from the war, the hotel's up, officers and sergeants only. That was respected because of the civilians who were running the hotels and the civilians who inhabited the hotels or used the hotels, and we knew what it meant. And to have these politicians to do these sort of things was just too much. I heard other cases about it and what they did. And we got our own back once. We had one politician, the Minister of the Army. he came up and he asked for demonstrations, which we hated. We had to go on parade, all togged up, and perform before him in rifle drill and things like that. He wore a bowler hat, which was a symbolic thing that we knew in the army. If you failed, you got a bowler hat. That was our talk. He came up and he insisted on this parade and everything else. Well, our chaps, we had a little platoon of 2-pounder anti-tank guns. And we loaded them with blank. And when he came up and he wanted to see this exercise and wanted to see them demonstrate, they demonstrated all right. They fired these blanks close to him and he jumped about 3 feet. And the whole crowd of us thought it was wonderful. And they showed our joy. We showed our joy too. He was known as the politician who kissed every baby that he could. That's how we knew him. But that's just an instance of how we disliked politicians and the way they'd carried on. I won't say that about our Prime Minister. We thought they were tops. We really thought they were tops. We thought Curtin and Shifley afterwards were really tops. We knew nothing about, or we saw little of Menzies and I just can't think of his name, the National Party man who took over for a short time when Menzies pulled out. But the Shepherd and Shifley and Curtin, we did not think much of our politicians. Well, that's about all I can say, I think.
I wanted to discuss with you. People talk about this sort of letdown feeling, anticlimax feeling on returning back from a war situation. Was that something you experienced?
No, I haven't got anything much to say about that. I know it was a short time after I came out from wounded. I was back in Queensland. I'd made an education officer. And that meant I had to go around the troops with passing on information that I had found, I'd received from the education officer brigade and division. Now I remember one case, I told these our men that when they came back to Australia, they would receive a grant of £800 to settle them into a house, to see they got a home. Towards the end of the war, I heard that that had been raised to £1,100. Now, that was quite a lot of money in those days, a hell of a lot of money. When I came back from the war, and when I occasionally came down from the farm, the country, into the city, I met some of these chaps, and they said to me, "Hey, what about that £800? Or what about that £1,100 we are going to get? We haven't received anything like that. We have been given a grant, but it's taken us a while to receive it, and we have not received anything like it." In the case of farmers, if you had any influence, and you got settled on the land, and they did very, very well. They were given a farm, more or less. It was supposed to be a 99-year lease. Eventually that 99 lease was cut out and the farm became theirs. But they were given the farm and very well looked after. But quite a few of them who'd put in for a farm never received any recognition at all. They went back onto a farm as farm labourers. And that's where they stayed, I think, unless they made their way and did well. A lot of them did. A lot of them did very well. They felt they were let down. In one case, or not, I shouldn't say one case, in one particular show, the housing chappie was the next man in charge, was the next officer of our battalion. And he did look after our battalion members to the best of his ability. and see that they got a fair go with the house loans and things like that. After the war, the house loans became not more frequent, but much better. They're granted much easier. And at the present day, we've got a wonderful Veterans Affairs office. They are really good. And they have proved themselves much better than they were soon after the war. Soon after the war, they were very, very hard to talk to. But they have improved after all recognition. And they have given our returned soldiers a wonderful, good conditions.
What are some of the bonds that you still hold with the chaps that you went away, and how are they different from family ties?
Well, we have a very good association journal, particularly I'm talking about our battalion members. I am friends with other members of other battalions, the 2nd 27th and those, but the 2nd 28th I meant, not the 27th, they're a South Australian crowd. But they're in our brigade. But these chaps, we have started off after the war. We started our magazine association up in Borneo, carried on down here. Luckily we had men who were connected with the newspapers, and they saw that we got started, a way of looking after the correspondence inwards and outwards with our troops, and we have had a wonderful association. Now, that carried on when we had hundreds of men in the association. Now, I think there's about, in West Australia, there'd be about 50 perhaps left. We have a lot in the eastern states who were our reinforcements, and they outnumbered us about 5-1 now. Actually, our magazine goes out to 850 people in Australia. That's our eastern states members, our widows, and our associates. Our widows have been wonderful. They have formed auxiliaries, and they have looked after troops very well in hospital visiting and things like that. But we have, outside of our association, we haven't had much contact at all. But our association has done wonders. We have what we consider the best battalion memorial in Australia, in the best position, up in Kings Park. We have now just recently opened the Kokoda track in Kings Park. And that has all been helped by the Veterans Affairs, by the government, and by our association.
Well, how important is it for you to see the Kokoda track going up Kings Park?
It has been wonderful. Unfortunately, I've only been able to see it from the top. When I was young, I used to go up and down it quite a lot. When I was young, as I say, before the war. But since then, I have not been up the track at all, that particular Kokoda track, because I couldn't manage it now.
What does it mean to you?
But it means a lot. We've got plaques, 7 or 8 plaques up from the top down to the bottom, commemorating the different battles we had in New Guinea with the Kokoda track, and it means a lot. And at the opening, when we opened it last May with the governor there, it was a wonderful experience. Not because the governor was there, because so many people turned up to it. And it was marked. It goes from our battalion memorial past the main state memorial down this pathway, marched with our coloured patch all the way down to the start of the Kokoda track, and from there goes right down to the bottom to Mounts Bay Road. And it is a wonderful thing. I have seen a little way down, but I have not been able to go up down it. I probably could go down it, but I couldn't come up it again. And it has been a wonderful thing. Those experiences have been wonderful. We when we have a death in our battalion, if it's in Karrakatta and we know about it. We all, what's left us, go along, and we have the Australian flag and our own battalion flag on that casket. And we follow that casket into the crematorium or to the burial ground. And many of our chaps can turn up, do so.